You're listening to Radically Pragmatic, a podcast from the Progressive Policy Institute. We talk with lawmakers, policy experts, and thought leaders about the issues driving the news nationally and internationally. The Progressive Policy Institute is a catalyst for policy innovation and political reform with offices in Washington, D.C. and Brussels. Its mission is to create radically pragmatic ideas for moving America beyond ideological and partisan deadlock. We encourage analytical conversations, not your typical partisan talking points.
Hello, everyone. This is Jasmine Stoughton, director of the Mosaic Project, and thank you for listening to this month's episode of the Mosaic Moment. For those of you who don't know, Mosaic is a project at the Progressive Policy Institute that aims to put more women at the forefront of policymaking. It's our mission to empower expert women with the tools and connections needed to engage with the media and lawmakers on today's toughest policy challenges. So first, allow me to introduce you to Ed Gresser. Ed is the Vice President and Director for Trade and Global Markets at PPI, and he will be your guest host for today's discussion. We're joined by two of Mosaic's newest alumni, Megan Bolton, who is of counsel at Ice Miller's Public Affairs Group, where she focuses her practice in technology and telecommunications policy, and Christine O'Connor, who currently serves as the Executive Director for the Alaska Telecom Association, whose members are Alaska's telecommunications carriers. Without further ado, let me turn over the conversation to Ed, Megan, and Christine.
Jasmine, thanks so much. And Megan and Christine, it's such a pleasure to be here with you today. It's a bit of introduction. Over the past week, I was looking at a report by the International Telecommunications Union on the state of the internet as of 2022. They had some quite remarkable numbers for me. And before we start our conversation, I'll share a couple of them. The biggest one was that last year, there were 5.3 billion people online worldwide. That is 2/3 of the world's people, up from a half of the world population in 2018 and a 10th in 2002. So we're seeing several hundred million people every year joining the internet user world. We see even faster growth of data exchange, up to 1,230 terabits per second last year. That's four times the bandwidth use of 2017. If you look then at some of the American data, you can see some of the economic consequences of this. The Bureau of Economic Analysis, that's the Commerce Department's major trade and economic statistical agency, says last year we have $89 billion in exports of information and communication services. We have about $600 billion in digitally deliverable services. That's everything from movies and software to banking and telemedicine. That makes the internet the vehicle for about a quarter of American exports to the world. And this is in turn about $3 in every 100 of US GDP. So you can see how many people this is touching, how fast this is growing, and how economically important it has become to the United States. In a single generation, if you look back to the launch of the internet in 1989 and the first browser known as Mosaic in 1993. So we have a ton of stuff to talk about, and we're so lucky to have Megan and Christine with their deep expertise in law and policy and advocacy and provision of services and direct business experience to talk about all this with us. So let's start, as Jasmine was saying, with the people and the access, and maybe with the exceptions. In the US, the statistic I see is that 93% of us have internet access, and that means 7% don't. 7% is not a huge number, but it is the equivalent of about 25 million people, which is not a small number. So maybe we start with Christine. Overseeing the world of telecommunications in Alaska. Who are the people who don't have access? Where are they? Where are the gaps? What are the challenges in closing them?
Yeah, good morning, Ed. Well, that number of, I think you said 7%, 25 million. We have a few more in Alaska. So we have about 16% that can't get 25x3, the new standard baseline for internet. And almost not all, but the vast majority of those folks are in our villages. So they're off the road system in Alaska, and the networks just haven't quite gotten there yet. which is, you can imagine, not having an internet connection over the past 3 years was really difficult. Just wasn't a matter of, you know, if you got support or something, the network just wasn't there in many cases. So yeah, that's kind of where our folks are. You know, in the lower 48, there are also a lot of rural folks. A lot of that 25 million are in rural areas, maybe not as remote as Alaska, but still similar challenges, similar distances, and just the challenge of getting the networks out.
And is the gaps, as you see, are they physical infrastructure? Are they policy and law? Are they lack of interest or awareness among people who could have service but don't?
I would say all of the above, but the biggest one for us in Alaska is just the networks aren't built out yet. We do have some networks in rural Alaska, which have been built with phenomenal world-class engineering feats, but they're just not everywhere yet. We estimate about 200 villages don't have connectivity. I'd say people not being interested is not really the case. Very, very low. What I see is that when you just absolutely can't access the internet, you know you need it. So folks are eager for these networks to be built out, which just, and thank goodness for the infrastructure bill and some of the federal programs that's underway. But due to the size and scale of the projects, it's probably going to take us 5 to 7 years to get the networks to folks. And then you have to juggle, you know, cost factors in there too. You know, these networks are phenomenally expensive, tens of millions of dollars to each region that you're going to reach in Alaska. So how that this gets to the policy and the programs that are out there, how do you not only build these networks, but make sure folks can afford to access them? Kind of a chicken and an egg question. You know, right now we're very focused on building them, which huge engineering challenges, really a lot of resources needed. But also in that mix is, in the end, when you flick the switch, can folks afford to subscribe?
Great. And let's, you know, that gives us a kind of close up look and maybe pull back a bit and go to Megan with your background in Congress, at the FTC, in advocacy here in Washington. Give us a sense of policy to date. How is the infrastructure bill going to change or upgrade it? What are the successes you've seen in closing digital divides? And where are you most concerned or worried about these days?
So, you know, this idea of universal service goes back a very long time. You know, the universal service fund goes back to 1996. What I'm heartened by, and what I think the success of a lot of advocacy from folks all over the country, folks like Christine in Alaska and other places, is the understanding that that connectivity really means robust broadband access. So really that shift from thinking about universal service, from baseline telecommunication service to broadband has been important. And there have been a lot of investments that the federal government has made along the way, right? Like in the 2009 omnibus stimulus bill, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, Congress acted to provide $4 billion in the BTOP program to start some of these projects, to get to these places where you have a sparse amount of consumers and the costs to build out these networks are extremely high. The Universal Service Fund has stood up Connect America Fund, and the RDOF fund at the FCC. So there've been significant investments along the way and millions and millions of dollars. I think the biggest success really is the combination of folks in Congress, folks in the administration, and the folks on the ground really coming together to bring forward what is really a once in a generation investment in broadband access in $65 billion through IIJA. Now, the way that this is going to be implemented is going to be interesting. I think a big part of it and the largest part of the conversation for folks here in DC and also folks around the country is the maps and getting this right, right? Because the baseline for making sure that this funding goes to the right places is making sure those maps are accurate. I think, you know, I want to applaud the FCC for the Herculean effort that they have undertaken to really produce more granular maps. I think the engagement on the ground with stakeholders is different than what we've seen before in previous iterations and in efforts by the federal government. So, you know, it's going to be a longer process, right? The BEAD funding is really going to be implemented over a course of 5 years. The middle mile grant program is going to be implemented sooner. And that's great because that adds capacity for folks who are closer to a fiber network. And, you know, we really are seeing the need for the higher capacity, especially coming out of the pandemic. So I think that's positive. And the last thing I'll note is really how the policy discussion has moved forward from just access to adoption. I remember 7 years ago, we had an economist come into the FCC and they were really talking about a project that a private provider was trying to bring forward in rural Virginia. But the issue was that the folks there didn't feel like there was a need. They didn't trust these people. You know, that barrier to adoption really stems from, you know, minimal education and opportunities around the digital economy. And I think that really ties well into the broader discussion that we're having today and talking about how I think on a global level and in part in the US, how folks are understanding that the trade of digital information really is a huge underpinning for our economy. So I'm heartened by the success we're having by bringing this policy forward. And I'm interested to see how we push forward in the future.
Yeah, let's pick up on that just a little bit. As a kind of expert watcher of policy and policy implementation, as IIJA goes into effect, what are some signs to be looking for? Is there something that would make you worried, or is there something that you would view as, I see this means we're on a good track?
Well, it's hard to say, right? I think we've learned a lot from the BTOP program. So I think we have some indicators that we want to look at. For example, the maps. I think like if we are finding as this challenge process goes forward and we're hearing from advocates on the ground that the maps still aren't, you know, a significant improvement from last, I think that would be the number one indicator. I also think that there are things that will come to bear as states and providers begin to apply for and implement this funding that will come to bear. For example, anecdotally, there are some smaller providers that are trying to figure out how to deal with what we call the letter of credit requirement, meaning they sort of have to park some money and put it to the side to show that the government that they have enough money to complete this, the projects that they receive the grant funding for. That they may not have access to, right? Like, you know, the banking system and the broader economic issues that we're facing as a country sort of underpin some of those issues. But I think that, you know, from what I'm hearing on the ground, NTIA is really working hard to try to work through those issues to make sure that folks are getting connected and that the solutions are incorporating people who are smaller providers to really bring it together, you know, that mosaic or that patchwork of different solutions to get everyone connected.
Great, thanks so much. And maybe turning from the 7% and the 34% to the 93% and the 66%, those who have access, who are regular users, so talk about some of the questions they have. Christine, maybe you could tell us a bit about what do you hear from the customers, your members? What are they most excited about? What are they hoping will come next? Those sorts of questions?
Yeah, great question. The folks I hear from in Alaska are mostly those that just don't have access and they want that network and they want it yesterday. There's a lot of excitement around LEO service. You know, we have OneWeb and Starlink over Alaska now, although Starlink's constellation isn't quite complete. And for folks that have had nothing and no access, those Starlink terminals are really, really, they're being deployed. They're not rock solid yet. So I think we are looking at those LEOs and what folks are looking at is this is a bridge until we can get a fiber network. Really agree with everything Megan said about how this is going. One of the other challenges everyone's looking at is how do you sustain a network long-term, 30, 50 years? You know, broadband has to be an ongoing service. How do you sustain that in a place where the population is maybe 20 households in a very economically disadvantaged, and all of Alaska is considered tribal areas? And those pieces aren't all in place yet. So that's a puzzle that a lot of folks, even in the general public, are aware of. And of course, particularly the providers are saying, okay, we have to piece together multiple federal programs, and they all have to work well together to make this not only get built, but operate indefinitely into the future.
Okay. Maybe you could bring that a little bit closer to people outside Alaska. The term village, I would say I've never lived in a state where we use the term villages. We would say small town or city. Tell us about village life. How many people are in a village? How far away from a main population center is it?
Sure. So in Alaska, we have a what we call a rail belt, a road system that kind of goes up partway through the state. Everything else is off the road system. So you're talking 100 miles, 200 miles, 300 miles away from the nearest road. And you can think of our villages. I grew up off the road system myself. Mm-hmm. We'll say in the bush is what we say here in Alaska, in a large community, which was about 2,000 people. So that's a hub community surrounded by a lot of very small communities, 100 people, 200-300 people, some were much smaller. And so these are traditionally, these are Native Alaskan communities, Yupik, Nupiat, in the interior we have Athabascan, all kinds of different, we have 229 federally recognized tribes in Alaska. So very small communities, you can almost think of them as islands in the middle of unpopulated, undeveloped land. So getting there to bring the network, we've done it with geosynchronous satellites all these years, which is better than nothing. It is great connectivity, you know, 10 years ago. Now that high latency, extremely high cost is not working so well. It's just not meeting the needs. So we are busy looking at this once in a lifetime opportunity to bring fiber, in some cases, microwave connections, to finally get real connectivity to what you can think of as an island in the middle of vast, empty wilderness.
And then Megan, how did, for a challenge like this, we have such a diverse country. We have, you know, very large states with villages. You have very dense urban populations, different connectivity challenges all over the place. How does the FCC or an administration generally conceptualize these problems, set priorities, and given all the money that Congress has now put into it, make sure this works as well as it ought to?
Yeah, I think it's taken years of advocacy and sort of getting to that point. As I mentioned before, there was a really huge emphasis on rural America and trying to physically connect places that just had difficult terrain or sparse subscribership. But as I mentioned, the conversation really evolved to the understanding that even in the urban core, where there is fiber and there is access, there are significant hurdles when it comes to affordability. And that is something that the FCC is doing a good job of addressing now with the ACP program. The ACP program is essentially a subsidy of up to a $30 discount on your telecommunications, or excuse me, your broadband service, which in some instances with some of the providers' offerings can make that service free. What that is doing is it's creating a place where folks are really understanding what they had been missing out on, the opportunities that are available over digital networks. Unfortunately, right now, the ACP program isn't permanent. I think there is a strong push to make some of that funding permanent. So that's essential. And in terms of thinking about how to properly allocate some of the funding for build out, I think that NTIA is doing a great job of really working hand in hand directly with states. I think in the past, there has been a lot of pushback in terms of that lack of communication, or really the lack of having folks at the local level having a seat at the table. And I think that's really going to inform the broadband plans that come out of the states and how that funding is going to be allocated.
Great. Let's turn our attention a little bit now to the international side and the trade side. The numbers that BEA puts out and studies by OECD really show that U.S. economy in particular, but also a number of economies, are become very reliant on data flows to keep the economy moving, very drawing a lot of export revenue and employment from exports of services, work on infrastructure. You know, as someone with a trade background, I've watched this for a while, and I can sort of see a fairly steady thickening of borders and a escalation of arguments and divisions among countries. Just to cite three of them, the World Trade Organization has had for now 34 years a moratorium on imposing tariffs and fees on electronic transmissions. That came under a lot of controversy last year, very sort of directed attempts by India and a few other countries to abolish that. You see a lot of interest and enthusiasm in Europe for taxing digital services, which is in some forms can be a way to transfer tax burdens from Europeans to American firms and workers. You see a very vigorous Chinese effort to create a kind of internet sovereignty concept, which involves a lot of rights of surveillance and intrusion of government into the data of users. Megan, maybe you can talk a little bit about how this looks to you. I mean, are we beginning to see the fraying and fragmentation of the internet? Is this something that is predictable and manageable? Do you have advice for U.S. government as it thinks about this international side?
Yeah, I think that the U.S. government is definitely being proactive in this space. I think, you know, if you look at the negotiations around USMCA and those trade agreements, you're seeing a provision on digital trade and the fostering of continuing to keep those lines open. I think you are seeing a fragmentation of fraying universally, just as you look between democratic countries, and you're looking at more authoritarian countries and the thickening of those borders. So I definitely do see that. One of the things I think that the Biden administration has done well is being proactive about addressing the privacy framework around cross-border data flows and really making an effort to work with the European Commission to basically bring back a framework that can foster that relationship. And also at the Department of Commerce, really focusing on the 70% of businesses that are actually providing these services to provide a low-cost option for them to comply with the new framework. The new framework has not yet been implemented, but President Biden signed an executive order to address some of the concerns that the European Commission had when they invalidated the last framework back in 2020. So I think that, you know, the U.S. government is thinking about this the right way. And, you know, I recently saw a blog from ITA saying that digital data flows underpin about $7.1 trillion in trade and the investment between the U.S. and Europe. So I think that we have the spotlight on the right issues and we're being proactive. But I think figuring out more creative ways to foster relationships or work with some of the other countries that are thickening those borders is going to be key to us continuing to keep the internet open.
Great. As a note on the data, $7.1 trillion, that's overall probably a quarter of all world trade, usually in the neighborhood of $25 to $30 trillion a year. So it's quite a significant sum. In a similar vein, you've seen a lot of discussion and a lot of concern in various ways over privacy and a kind of very kind of flamboyant hearing over the TikTok service. How do you as an expert view this? Should Americans feel confident about their data privacy and security? Are there things that are emerging that they should be more worried about than they are? Or do you see things that people are worried about that they shouldn't be so worried as they seem to be?
I think there's a lot of pressure to get something done in terms of a national privacy standard, right? I think states like California have taken the lead, and other states around the country have sort of followed that. But I think, you know, the temperature is really rising. I think the issue is that in Congress, we have very slim margins, you know, and even with those slim margins, we basically got an agreement with all but one of the four corners, sort of the Republican and Democrat leads on the committees of jurisdiction agreeing on a privacy package. So I'm hopeful that there will be some some progress on privacy in the next Congress, but unfortunately with the gridlock currently with our limited margins, that seems unlikely. I think that there is at least a bipartisan interest in protecting children online. So if I'm someone watching the privacy discussion, I would look at that.
Great, thank you. And Christine, you may have a really interesting kind of double perspective on the business side of this. You're a very well-informed member of the service provider community. You're also, as I've read, a salmon farmer. I'm aware the Alaska fishing industry is a highly global industry and selling to Japan and China and all over the world. Tell us a bit about maybe both sides of this. The ways businesses are using Alaska telecom services and the way maybe if you are, you as a entrepreneur yourself are able to use internet and telecom to find foreign and worldwide customers.
Yeah, a couple things come to mind. One, just talking about the sheer quantity of data that's flying, you know, globally. And then I work really on the local level with very small providers, a lot of them cooperatives, community owned. And that volume is threatening to crush the networks all the time because, you know, the demand curve is a hockey stick up. So what has happened often is a small rural provider, you know, off the road system builds a microwave network in. It should last 5 years. In 2 years, it's at capacity. You know, so keeping up with that constant demand and the content or the edge providers, they churn it out with no thought and with they get quite an advantage from these small rural networks. So figuring out how to navigate that balance to keep up with that growing volume is tricky and very expensive. And then just on the pure doing business in Alaska, I am a commercial fisherman. So we catch sockeye salmon in the largest sustainable wild salmon fishery in the world. It's actually a model for sustainability that other countries come and study. So we capture our salmon, catch them. I like that capture.
Okay. I withdraw the term farmer.
yes, please. That's a whole other conversation. And I hope you're eating wild salmon this morning for breakfast. Oh, that's amazing. So perfect. Very healthy. But what we do is we catch our salmon and then we sell them to a processor who then has to operate on the world market. Just as you said, most of us don't do that individually, but our buyer has to get a good deal, sell that on a worldwide market. So we're subject to those fluctuations and it can be a really baffling thing to try to understand a world market. So again, bringing kind of that back to connectivity, our buyer, who's also processing our salmon, who then end up in China to be reprocessed, so that international complications are in there, he has to have connectivity to be monitoring the markets during the season, being able to interact and make sure he's getting the best price for our wonderful salmon that he can turn around and pay us a good price. So yeah, it's just kind of a very local example of a global market.
Right. And I guess maybe as a final question, a little bit more personally, like you've both chosen careers in digital technology and telecom policy. What brought you to this world? What, if anything, has surprised you about it? What are your big hopes for the next 5 years?
Well, for me, I actually came to telecommunications by way of work I did in law school with the NAACP. During our workshop that we had the past week, there was actually a quote from John Lewis talking about how the digital divide is the civil rights sort of fight of our time. And, you know, just understanding the way that digital opportunities have really shaped the economy, how they have opened doors for folks all over the country, how, you know, and frankly, in a lot of ways with telehealth and other ways is saving lives. It's always something that I feel like no matter where I am, like right now I'm in the private sector, I've been in the government. I feel like no matter what end of the spectrum that you're working on this policy, there is a direct impact to improving people's lives. So I think kind of having that mission focus and also sort of being on the cutting edge of how, you know, the economy is changing, you know, thinking about issues that come up around like Web3 and really having a deep policy understanding is something that drives me and keeps my life interesting. And, you know, in terms of the next 5 years, you know, I'd really like to see a significant change, and the funding from this latest investment really open doors for people. I think that it's going to drive more innovation. I think that it will drive competitiveness in the U.S. in terms of technology. So I'm really hopeful about this, and I'm excited to be here in Washington and work on these issues at a really pivotal time.
Christine?
Yeah, I would agree. This is such an exciting time. Well, to back up how I ended up in telecom in Alaska, I was the librarian in my hometown of Dillingham, and I was elected to the cooperative board. And that was my first insights into telecom, and that you could actually improve access for your neighbors. So that's been over 20 years. And what's exciting to me is that this is the infrastructure Alaska needs, my neighbors need, my relatives need, still living in rural Alaska. And to be able to actually help with that through the work you're doing is, it's energizing. We've always had a scarcity of resources. You know, folks need, it was clear for quite a long time, folks needed broadband, but from the provider community, it was always trying to say, oh, if we only had more resources. Now we have resources. So it's very exciting to be in a place to be working on how best to implement a full build out of broadband infrastructure in Alaska. That's just really exciting. I've been using the word transformational, and not lightly. I mean, it truly, in 5 years, we don't even know what's going to happen once we have access for everyone, and, you know, afford access plus affordability. And those are knit together in the infrastructure bill, and how that plays out and what happens after that comes. It's just really exciting. And I truly a privilege to be part of. So that's kind of what keeps me excited about it.
Well, that's great. Thank you both so much for your time this morning. Congratulations on your work, and I wish you both the best. Thank you so much for your participation in the Mosaic program, and thank you, Jasmine, for giving us this time.
Thanks for listening. Want to learn more about the Progressive Policy Institute? Follow us on Twitter at PPI and on Facebook at Progressive Policy Institute, or go to our website at progressivepolicy.org. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen and check back for new episodes. We'll talk with you soon.